This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Coming up, farmers plead for borders to reopen, warning if they can't find enough workers, crops might go to waste. Battling business owners in Victoria get some long-awaited state government financial support as they wait for restrictions to ease.
I think we're all hoping that there's going to be an announcement that we can open a little bit more in all throughout regional Victoria. You know, it's that hope that sort of helps us to get out of bed in the morning and keep going.
A massive database compiled by a Chinese company with links to the country's military and intelligence network has been revealed this morning. It holds the names and details of 2.4 million people around the world. More than 35,000 of them are Australian. The data dump suggests a complex global operation scouring publicly available information to create intricate profiles of people and organisations, potentially probing for compromising intelligence. Here's political reporter Matthew Doran.
You'd normally be hard-pressed to find a link between singer Natalie Imbruglia, current Victorian Supreme Court Judge Anthony Kavanagh, former Foreign Minister Bob Carr, and tech entrepreneurs Mike Cannon-Brookes and Scott Farquhar. But they're among the 35,000 Australians who all feature on a database of size and detail rarely seen by Western intelligence agencies, with little to no explanation as to why each of them are on the list.
I think it speaks to the broader threat of what China is doing and how they are surveilling, monitoring, and seeking to influence not just their own citizens, but citizens around the world.
US-based Professor Christopher Boulding is the man who was handed this vast trove of information. It was compiled by Shenzhen-based company Junhua Data, which counts the People's Liberation Army and Chinese Communist Party among its main clients. It's also believed to be used by China's intelligence service, the Ministry of State Security. The information collected includes names, dates of birth and photographs, all which can be gleaned from social media and other public forums. But Professor Boulding says it goes much, much further. Some of the 2.4 million profiles include information from confidential bank records, job applications and psychological profiles, all of which could be used to put pressure on individuals who might be of use to the company and its clients.
China is absolutely building out a massive surveillance state, both domestically and internationally. They're using a wide variety of tools.
Junhua has boasted on its own website that it vacuumed up the information using 20 collection nodes, computer servers sitting around the world throwing out digital fishing nets.
There's almost certainly one in Australia.
Professor Clive Hamilton is from Charles Sturt University.
Where is that centre? And if we can find it, shouldn't we close it down?
Clive Hamilton has had weeks to pore over the information. He says while it's clear that some people, such as politicians, would be of interest to Chinese companies and authorities, this database takes surveillance to the next level, with family members and children also included.
So it really is quite sinister. This approach that China has taken is really a very, very broad approach to citizens in general who may or may not be of use now or at some time in the future.
The database was made available to a consortium of international media outlets, including the Australian Financial Review and the ABC. The group has contacted Junhua for comment, but no response has been received.
Matthew Doran reporting there. A former Australian fighter pilot is under investigation by the United Nations for allegedly planning a mercenary operation for a Libyan warlord. UN investigators have compiled 140 pages of damning evidence against a group of private military contractors, and it singles out Australian man Christian Durant as a key organiser. Dylan Welch from Four Corners reports.
Hussein Najir is about to receive one of the strangest calls of his life.
Hi, Hussein.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, good. So I'm Dylan Welch. I'm a reporter with the ABC in Australia.
Hussein Najir is a Libyan-Irish citizen who fought in the Revolutionary Army that overthrew Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011.
Brilliant. Nice to meet you, Dylan.
So, Hussein, I've seen a list created by a group of Western mercenaries. It's a list of Libyans that they're accused of planning to kidnap or kill for Khalifa Haftar.
Okay.
And your name's on that list.
Well, I'm not aware of this document in particular, but that's something you'll probably have to show me later on.
Hussein Najir is one of nine men identified as high-value targets by a mercenary operation which included several Australian operatives.
What is my crime for me to be put on any list? What is my crime to face you know, death. We're talking about death. We're not talking about imprisonment.
The kill list, obtained by Four Corners, was proposed as part of a plot to help warlord Khalifa Haftar overthrow the internationally recognised Libyan government, an operation which ultimately failed.
If that's their motive, if their motive is, here's a hit list, kill this guy, you know, that's the end of it. I mean, if they are just cold-blooded killers, then I have nothing to say to them.
A Four Corners investigation can reveal the UN has found that former Australian Air Force fighter pilot Christian Durant breached a Libyan arms embargo for his alleged role in the plot. And although he didn't deploy to Libya, he was at least complicit in the planning and execution of a military operation in support of an armed group in Libya. Stephanie Williams is the UN's acting envoy to Libya.
All of the work of the panel is extremely important. But it's what is done with all of that, and when it hits the sanctions committee, what do the member states do? How are the violators of the arms embargo held accountable? Let the sun shine on all of this. I'm all for the transparency, but the transparency has to be paired with accountability.
The Australian government has been provided copies of the UN's reports. If the allegations are proven here, Christian Durant could face up to 10 years in jail and fines of up to $500,000. The 50-year-old declined an interview, but said in a statement, "We don't breach sanctions, we don't deliver military services, we don't carry guns, and we are not mercenaries." He also said the UN investigation is relying on false documents, and the operation was for oil and gas contracts and not to provide military support to Khalifa Haftar. Hossein Najjar is waiting to see what happens.
Whether it be targeted as me, myself, or civilians as a whole, I think it's very important that the Australian population and country understand and know that one of their citizens is being implicated in these kind of actions.
That's former Libyan revolutionary fighter Hossein Najjar ending that report by Dylan Welch. And in a statement, the Department of Foreign Affairs says it works closely with its law enforcement partners to enforce sanction laws where there's a suspected breach. You can watch the Four Corners investigations, Soldiers of Fortune, tonight 8:30 on ABC TV. With the fruit and grain harvesting season fast approaching, farmers are increasingly anxious about whether they'll have enough workers due to border closures. The Peak Farming Lobby Group says Australians should be able to keep all or part of their JobKeeper payment as an incentive to take up fruit picking work. Usually, backpackers are a source of hired help, but with their numbers in freefall, the tourism industry's also joined calls for creative solutions to the problem. Gavin Coote reports.
The nation's crop of stone fruits like mangoes, plums and cherries are just about due for harvest, but a lack of seasonal workers has put much of that in doubt.
We normally have about 135,000 backpackers coming into the country for holiday makers, and this has almost halved because of the border closures. There's obviously since last year. So there's billions of dollars of product that is potentially wasting away in the ground or on trees.
Tony Marr is the chief executive of the National Farmers Federation, which has been looking at ways of easing the pressure on the $14 billion horticulture industry. Among the suggestions, allowing Australians on JobSeeker to be able to keep all or part of their unemployment payment if they take up farm work during the harvest.
We've put forward a 10-point plan to the government to say, here's 10 things that we think will help with this situation. One of them is incentives to allow people to actually earn a level of money that won't affect their Social Security system payments. So definitely incentives along those lines, but also, you know, things like accommodation support and, you know, promotion for work in the agriculture sector. So things like a gap year. So instead of students finishing year 12 and going off to do a gap year around the world, we think it's a great idea for Australian students to spend a gap year in Australia and travel around this beautiful country, experience farm work, earn some money, and then go off to university.
The closure of borders remains another big sticking point for the agriculture sector. All states except Western Australia, Queensland and Tasmania have signed an agriculture workers code which allows free movement across state borders. But both the agriculture and tourism sectors want the federal government to look at easing the international border closure, while also granting visa extensions to overseas backpackers who are still in Australia. Simon Westaway is the executive director of the Australian Tourism Industry Council.
Sadly, the program is in freefall. More than 10,000 backpackers, we understand, are leaving the country a month as their visas, even those that were short-term extended at the height of the first wave of COVID, start to leave the country. In essence, we have less than half the normal number of backpackers we should have in country at any particular time. We have a significant run rate of loss of backpackers as their visas expire and return. They're not being topped up in terms of return visitors, obviously with our hard internal border and those very, very hard and harsh flight caps and visitor entry caps which are in place. So the pipe is an important one. It's been turned off, and sadly it will pretty much diminish by early next year unless we can find some surgical action and find some mitigations to keep the program going until conditions get better.
Yeah, surgical action. Does the government appear to be receptive to the idea of a potential extension?
We believe so. I think they are looking at innovations. I mean, they were innovative earlier this year. The sad thing is we've got to continue to be innovative.
In a statement to AM, the Federal Agriculture Minister, David Littleproud, says it will take all levels of government working together to get the food and fibre this year to market. He says if the states don't open their borders for agricultural workers, it's going to be very difficult for this season's work to be done.
Gavin Coote reporting there. There's another influential voice calling on the federal government to promote migration as a key plank of the post-COVID-19 economic recovery. It's the Committee for Economic Development Australia, better known as CEDA. The group's chief economist, Jared Ball, is speaking here with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
When international borders do open more fully and there is greater migration, making sure that we're competitive and that we're attracting the right skills. So, for example, intra-company transfers, making sure that multinational companies can bring high-level executives to Australia easier to grow their businesses. I think it will be more important than ever with a higher rate of unemployment that people have confidence, both employers and the community, that we've got the skills lists right.
There's so much uncertainty at the moment. For example, international borders look like being closed until at least early next year. How concerned are you that this could become permanent?
Let's see where things land next year. But certainly there's opportunities in the interim. We've seen in South Australia, for example, they've obviously brought back a number of international students willing to spend that time doing quarantine and making sure that they re-enter Australia safely. So I think there's some ways to work with this.
Temporary migrants like students and skilled workers currently don't get JobKeeper or JobSeeker, even though they do pay tax here. Do those programs need to be extended, and do those temporary migrants need to be treated better?
Temporary migrants in normal times pay taxes but don't receive welfare. This is a once in a 100-year event. Borders are very restricted. It's not so easy to just go back home. And a number of countries such as the UK, Canada, France, New Zealand have extended these sorts of benefits to temporary migrants. So in terms of being a good global citizen, I think it's quite important that we send the right signal to the international community about how we approach temporary migration.
How important is it for the federal government to avoid populist policies, given the mistakes that were made in previous recessions, but also in the Great Depression in the 1930s, where migrant workers were sent home?
It's a really important point, Peter. And what you see from the experience of the global financial crisis, particularly in Europe and the Northern Hemisphere, was that negative sentiment around migrants and migration rose after the global financial crisis. So that's something that we need to be very vigilant about in this country.
That's Jared Ball, a chief economist for the Committee for Economic Development Australia, speaking there with Peter Ryan. Battling businesses in Victoria are getting some long-awaited support from the state government with a $3 billion cash grants and tax relief package. While COVID-19 case numbers are falling, business owners say the best support they could receive right now would be the easing of restrictions to allow them to operate again, as Sarah Sedgie reports.
For businesses in Victoria's Alpine region, the winter months are the most important.
It's very quiet when this is normally a peak period of trading, a time that we can guarantee that trade that we receive during these winter months will help us for the remainder of the 9 months of the year.
Glenys Peacock owns a cafe and ski shop in Mount Beauty and is president of the local Chamber of Commerce.
Running a business is not just about the customer service and turning up and opening the doors. It's a lot of planning that goes into it. And having to adjust quickly with a couple of days' notice that the new restrictions are and what you have to do or the cleaning processes or we're going to close, you quickly have to think of how to adapt and how to get through the next phase. And it's exhausting.
The Victorian government is hoping a new $3 billion package, including cash grants and tax breaks, will help sustain small and medium businesses.
The assistance, financial assistance that the government have provided has certainly helped. But whether it's enough, only each individual business will be able to answer that.
But the biggest economic boost can only come when coronavirus restrictions are eased. And Professor Mark Stouvet, who's head of public health at the Burnet Institute for Medical Research, says things are on track.
I think it's looking very good. We need to be very careful about our assumptions, but certainly the trends are looking very good.
But one of the government's most crucial goals in its roadmap to reopening is bringing down the number of cases with an unknown source.
I think that's what the government will be most concerned about, is the unknown cases, it being unknown where the case was acquired from. Those numbers do need to be very low before we lift further restrictions. It only takes one or two cases in the wrong place and things will take off again. I think the important thing now is to preparedness of the Victorian government for those low numbers of unknown cases. I think they're doing a tremendous effort at the moment in scaling up, improving the technology, improving their processes around contact tracing, because even those very low number of cases that are from an unknown source can seed outbreaks.
While Melbourne could still be under restrictions for many weeks, Premier Daniel Andrews is holding out hope that regional Victoria could see some easing within days. For business owners like Glenys Peacock, that means she's a step closer to welcoming visitors again.
I think we're all hoping that next week there's going to be an announcement that we can open a little bit more in all throughout regional Victoria. You know, it's that hope that sort of helps us to get out of bed in the morning and keep going.
As business owner Glenys Peacock ending Sarah Sedgie's report. In the UK, new restrictions on social gatherings will come into force today as the British government grapples with a sharp rise in COVID-19 numbers. Over the weekend, there were more than 6,800 new cases. Numbers are doubling about every 7 days. Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley reports from London.
The summer COVID reprieve is now over. Across the weekend, more than 3,000 new cases were recorded on consecutive days. Peter Openshaw, a professor from Imperial College London, is a member of the scientific group advising the government on COVID-19.
The main point is that we must act fast because it's so much harder to get this sort of thing under control. If you delay even a few days, it's potentially going to be quite dangerous now at this particular moment.
What will be concerning the British government most now is that the number of cases is doubling every 7 days.
The reproduction number has now jumped. You know, it was down at about 0.5 at its best during the summer. It's now 1.7. So that's 1.7 people for every person who's infected, and that means exponential growth.
From today, gatherings of more than 6 people are illegal. But it didn't stop groups partying on the weekend.
It does feel a little bit like you was encouraged to go out, eat, drink, you know, we have to, like, get the economy going, and now it's a bit like it's all your fault.
Since the start of the pandemic, the British government has been criticised for its mixed messaging. But Boris Johnson has been adamant he will not introduce a second national lockdown. Some scientists say it may be unavoidable as the cold winter months descend. Robert Buckland is the Justice Secretary.
Well, look, as the Prime Minister said, going to a national lockdown would indeed be a nuclear option.
The British government is facing questions over 2 leaked reports. One reveals the virus is starting to take hold in the nation's care homes again. The Department of Health document reportedly shows outbreaks have occurred in 43 homes. Another shows the government's COVID testing program is in chaos, with a backlog of more than 180,000 swabs. Maria van Kerkhove from the WHO says the virus has a long way to go.
I mean, if we look at the proportion of the population that is actually still remains susceptible, only about 10% of the world's population has been exposed and has some evidence of infection, which means that most people remain susceptible.
Across the channel, there is a concerning rise in case numbers too. France is faring particularly badly, with around 10,000 cases a day, the highest number recorded since the pandemic began. It could take at least 3 weeks to determine whether the new restriction on gatherings here is working to reduce the trend in Britain. This is Samantha Hawley in London, reporting for AM.
In the United States, billionaire Michael Bloomberg has promised to plough $140 million into the state of Florida alone in an urgent effort to thwart President Donald Trump's momentum in the crucial swing state. Democratic challenger Joe Biden's seen his healthy lead erode in recent weeks, and now polls put him roughly even with the president. North America correspondent David Lipson reports.
It's not a voter block usually associated with Donald Trump. Not positively anyway, but the president is now running hard to win the hearts and minds of Hispanics.
I love the Hispanic community.
At a rally in Nevada overnight, he said Hispanics understand issues about the US-Mexico border better than anyone.
Our incredible border agents, they're incredible people, more than half of whom happen to be Hispanic Americans. Did you know that? I know all of them. Jose, how you doing? Juan, how you doing?
Polls in recent days have delivered welcome news to the Trump campaign in the crucial state of Florida. He's ahead of Joe Biden amongst the key Hispanic bloc of voters in the Sunshine State. All the more significant because in 2016, Hillary Clinton won the Florida Latino vote by 27 points, but still lost the state.
We're not paying much attention to what the polls say.
Democrats like Florida Congresswoman Val Demings are now the ones claiming opinion polls don't matter. She was on CNN.
We are continuing to work hard with what I believe is a very effective ground game.
Across all demographics in Florida, Joe Biden's lead has shrunk from a high of 7.4 points in June to 2.6 points today, according to an average of polls by the website 538. Enter Michael Bloomberg. The billionaire former New York mayor has promised to dump $140 million on Florida alone to pay for wall-to-wall TV and digital ads in English and Spanish. He spent $1 billion on his own failed presidential campaign and has promised to spend whatever it takes to ensure Donald Trump doesn't win a second term. But for Trump, Florida is a new spiritual home, and he's making sure Floridians get what they want as well. Last week, he left the energy industry gobsmacked after signing a ban on all new oil drilling off the Florida coast until 2032.
Who would have thought? Trump is the great environmentalist. Do you hear that, Ed? Do you hear that?
With its swag of electoral college votes, Florida matters for both candidates. It's been almost 100 years since a Republican won the White House without it. If the president loses Florida, an alternate path to victory is hard to imagine. For Joe Biden, there are other ways to win the election without Florida, but a victory would be much easier with the state in his column. He'll visit there next week. This is David Lipson in Washington for AM.
And our latest podcast, America If You're Listening, hosted by Matt Bevin, is looking back at Mr. Trump's past 4 years in office as his campaign to win another four continues. You can find it on the ABC Listen app. Later today, Japan will find out who its next Prime Minister will be as the ruling Liberal Democratic Party votes on a replacement for Shinzo Abe, who's standing down because of ill health. Whoever gets the job will inherit an economy pummeled by the pandemic, as North Asia correspondent Jake Sturmer reports from Tokyo.
With a fist thrust forward, Japan's former defence minister Shigeru Ishiba and his supporters yell, "Let's do our best," as he campaigns to become the head of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party and therefore the next prime minister. His rivals are ex-foreign minister Fumio Kishida and the chief cabinet secretary Yoshihide Suga, a long-time aide to Shinzo Abe and the face of the government's twice daily briefings. With Japan's economy recording its biggest decline since the end of World War II, Yoshihide Suga says tackling the global pandemic and restoring that economy are his top priorities. And while he has greater party support, his two rivals have more foreign policy experience, something that matters now more than ever with China's military build-up in the South China Sea and intrusions around Japanese-controlled islands. Sophia University's Professor Koichi Nakano says negotiating the relationship with China will be crucial.
Under Mr. Abe, since Trump came to power, he has been sort of pushed to work more closely with Xi Jinping, almost against his own inclinations, because of the trade war that Mr. Trump waged against both China and Japan.
Jim Schoaf is a senior fellow in the Carnegie Asia Program and used to work in the US Department of Defense on US-Japan policy development. He says the next leader will face a challenge forging the same strong personal relationship that outgoing Prime Minister Shinzo Abe had cultivated with the US President Donald Trump.
His foreign policy was remarkable for Japan in terms of the energy, the activity, the diversity of it, the breadth. And I think they were very strategic, and I think he was a big part of that. And I don't know if Suga has the same level of energy and the ability to connect with people that Abe did.
But he says there's also an opportunity to strengthen the relationship between Australia and Japan.
Japan can't wait for the United States to lead in this next phase, and it can't do it by itself, so it has to do it with other players and other partners. And that's where I think these relationships with Australia, India, Europe are so key.
Shinzo Abe departs after almost 8 years as Prime Minister. He's a leader who brought stability and ended what had been a revolving door within Japanese politics. His replacement will have to quickly establish himself and hit the ground running. This is Jake Sturmer in Tokyo reporting for AM.
When coronavirus first spread across the world, many international borders were shut, with the tourism industry pretty much brought to a standstill. As lockdowns lift, many governments, including some states here, are urging people to holiday at home. But one country is offering an extra incentive to do so. Thailand is paying its citizens to go on holidays. Here's Southeast Asia correspondent Mazoe Ford.
Thailand's beautiful beaches are a tourist draw card, but there aren't many travellers at the moment. The country's borders remain shut to international visitors, but after almost 4 months of lockdowns, Thai people can now go on holidays.
I'm very happy because I've been stressed at work and at home all the time, and I wanted to come out to relax.
Thailand was the first nation outside China to detect a case of COVID-19, but there were low infection rates and the country quickly flattened its curve. The closed borders and lockdowns saw tourism grind to a halt, though, so the Thai government is now trying to jumpstart the domestic tourism industry by paying people to take holidays. It's offering 40% off airfares and accommodation and daily spending money. Bangkok man Kettisat Kemsirapat has taken his family to the seaside town of Krabi.
Local people can travel inside Thailand again. This is a very good thing to do because we had to find a balance between the economy and health.
Assistant Professor of Economics at Bangkok's Chulalongkorn University, Jessica Weibanyonrat, isn't convinced the program will work.
Has the program actually helped induce demand? It has to some extent, but it's never going to cover the drop in international tourism.
Thailand was expecting 40 million foreign tourists this year. The latest estimate is there'll be only 8 million.
For some hotels, some restaurants, it will help them just to hopefully stay in business and just make it through the pandemic, but it's not going to save the industry, I don't think.
Glurkit Panapuan owns a restaurant in the misty mountains of Chiang Mai in Thailand's north. It's filling up with the sounds of hot woks and happy diners once more.
Normally during the rainy season, we'd have less customers. But this year, after the government eased the lockdown, it was the opposite. We didn't even consider it low season. It's been the best season in the past 11 years.
The government is considering allowing foreigners to return, but only if they're planning to stay for several months and agree to go into hotel quarantine on the island of Phuket. Travel bubbles with other low-infection countries have also been discussed, but as some of those countries experience a second wave, that's a risk many Thais don't want to take.
That's our Southeast Asia correspondent, Zoe Ford. That is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Everyone was looking for Nicola Gobbo, the woman who became known as Lawyer X.
The woman at the centre of Victoria's biggest legal scandal.
Since going into hiding, the only interview she's done is with the ABC. And now we can tell her full story.
People were going to be murdered.
She was working both sides of the fence.
I will make a point of holding those who did this to account.
The Informer, a gripping new season of the hit podcast Trace. Hear it on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.